So we're currently still in the study of the part of the Exodus, or the book of the Exodus, that deals with the case laws. This chapter on case laws, so also known as the Book of the Covenant, contains detailed applications of the Decalogue. I've said this over and over again, that God is not just going to give us a general command or commands in the Decalogue and not give us some kind of, you know, resource in order for us to learn how to apply it. And so this is what the case laws are all about. So we finished the first part of the instructions, which dealt with slavery. I hope you were here for that. If you missed any of the messages, please go check it out in our YouTube page. So this morning, I'm going to try to unpack for you the rest of the instructions in chapter 21. And it deals with crime and punishment. Crime and punishment. This is, again, another sensitive social issue in our times because of the seemingly severe punishments being prescribed in these laws. I don't know if you read it, right? There's some severe punishments that are being prescribed there or described. Now, again, we need to remember that these laws were originally given to the nation of Israel, who was living in the context of the ancient Near East. Like, we can't look at this and just apply it to our context right now, and vice versa. We can't take our context and read it into this text. And I say that because the punishments God gave the Israelites containing these verses do not always apply to our situation today. No more oxes that are goring people. Have you ever heard of oxes goring people nowadays? No, people gore oxes nowadays. You eat too much of them. So Reichen comments that these laws do not give us a complete code. It doesn't give us a complete code with regulations for all the situations that may arise from every culture. I believe that these verses have been written for us to examine the cases that are used here as examples. And then, from there, use these cases to help us understand and give us wisdom to apply God's justice within the context of an unjust world. Again, I believe that the ultimate purpose for these laws is for the protection of those who cannot protect themselves from the tyranny of sinful men. And that's why it started with laws for slaves. Who are the slaves back in those days? The poorest of the poor. If you were to look at the social statuses of people there, the slaves were at the lowest. Right? And then last week, we took up laws that protect women and children. Why women and children? Because they're the most vulnerable members of society back in those days. And now we're going to see laws that protect everyone in society, including slaves, from sinful men who commit acts of crime and violence against other human beings. So our text this morning in Exodus 21 can be divided into three sections that deal with crimes against other human beings. The first section we're going to deal with is capital crimes. The second section that we're going to deal with is personal injuries. And the last section we're going to deal with is criminal negligence. Okay? Capital crimes, personal injuries, criminal negligence. And based on these sections, there seems to be a sense that some crimes are greater than others. Do you think that? Do you think some crimes are worse than others? I guess if you were to measure the crimes according to the damage that it caused, then some crimes are greater than others. But ultimately, all crimes against human beings, and even nature for that matter, are sins against God, who is the creator of everything. So the laws that we will be taking up gives us a sense of proportion and wisdom to see which punishment fits the crime. Okay? And this morning we're going to take these up one by one. Let's start with Exodus 21, 12 to 17. Can you guys read that again?
I will appoint for your place to be chief. But if a man willfully attacks his kids clothing by cutting, you shall take it from my altar that I give him back. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Whoever kills a man that sells sin, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death.
So first section is what? Capital crimes. What are capital crimes? Simply put, capital crimes are crimes that are worthy of the highest form of punishment. What is the highest form of punishment? Death. Death sentence, right? Now, why death? First, if the punishment should be proportionate to the crime, then if someone takes a life, then the murderer should pay with their life. Second, and more importantly, the taking of a life and arguably the mistreatment of another human being is a sin against God because all human beings were created in His image. So when you attack a human being, you're attacking God because all human beings are made in His image. Therefore, an assault on a human being is a direct assault on God Himself, against God Himself, and deserves the highest form of punishment. The main example that we see in the text that would involve a death sentence involves the willful taking of a life. Willful. And you planned it. Premeditated murder. But the other examples are a bit more complicated, right? Did you see that when you were reading? That's why I make you guys read. I want you guys to see. Other examples are a bit more complicated. First would be the unintentional killing of a human being in verse 13. Verse 13 once again says this. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. The murderer, right? The NLT translates this verse as, but if it was simply an accident permitted by God, I will appoint a place of refuge where the slayer can run for safety. Or the New King James translates it as, however, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, and I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. One more translation, NASB. Yet if he did not lie in wait for him, but God caused him to fall into his hand, and I will appoint for you a place that which he may flee. So all three translations, along with the ESB, describes this form of murder as something that is beyond human control. It seems like it was God who allowed, who placed, who put this person in the hands of the murderer. They're all beyond human control. The commentary that I'm reading for this says that these crimes are crimes of passion. In other words, this is murder that is not premeditated, or a murder that happened in the heat of an argument or of self-defense. Right? Now, God's providence for this type of murder seems unjust from a human standpoint, right? What if you were the family of the one that was murdered? And they say, it's an accident. I was holding a gun, flailing it around, and it went off. Accident. What if that was you? Or what if one of your family members got into a fight and was accidentally killed? It seems unjust because God's saying, don't touch this person. I will provide a place of refuge for this person. Even if there was a death that happened. So if you look at the culture back then, there are some cultures in the ancient world where the punishment for such a crime would be called, a revenge killing. What's a revenge killing? This means that the one who committed the crime would be legally killed by the relatives of the victim. Back in those days, that was the practice. You killed my dad, you killed my father, you killed my son. I get to kill you legally. Right? For me, I was reading up on it. I'm like, that's pretty good. That seems fair. Because I'm imagining, what if my kids get murdered and they say it's an accident and they get to go wherever, the place of refuge. That's what it says here. It doesn't seem fair for the victim's family. The revenge seems fair. Who agrees? Doesn't that just seem fair? But what does God say about vengeance?
12:17-19. But he will not do what is honorable in the sight of God. Possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with each other. Beloved, never avenge yourselves. Give it to the wrath of God, for you will be vengeance is mine. I will repay it, says the Lord.
Right? Paul says, don't repay anyone evil for evil. Leave the avenging to God, who is the one or the only one to avenge rightly. Right? Think about it. If the initial murder was committed, was a crime of passion, what would you call the revenge killing? Same thing. Right? You would be. I'm not going to go in there, kill somebody, and then I'm not angry. Like, I'll just, okay, I have to kill you because you killed my relative. No, right? You would be angry. Like, it would be a crime of passion. So if it's a crime of passion, then the relatives of the person that murdered your relative would have to murder you. Because it was a crime of passion. And then when they murder you, your relatives would have to murder them. Unless you can murder somebody with no anger. This is not a crime of passion. Then he's just going to keep going and going and going. There will be no end to this cycle. That's like the Hamas and the Israelites. It's not going to end. Right? So God proposed a better way. This is what he'd been doing the whole time, right? He proposed a better way with this law. For an unintentional murder, God designated cities of refuge where the killer could stay until a proper investigation and due process is given to the incident to determine whether or not the crime was intentional or not. So what happens is if I'm involved in this, I was the murderer, I would go run to the city of refuge. I would put my hand on the altar of God. As long as my hand is on the altar, nobody can touch me. That's the law. Right? As long as my hand is on that altar, you can go and investigate. But no one is to touch the perpetrator until the investigation is done. Now, if after due process, the perpetrator was proven innocent, and he was allowed to live. If not, not even the altar could save him. Right? He would be put to death. See, rule number one. Right? So that's the first one. Complicated. Capital crime, but it was unintentional. So God says, yeah, let them have their due process. Innocent until proven guilty. I think in Europe it's the other way around. Guilty until proven innocent. But here, it's innocent until proven guilty. Okay? Next example of a capital crime is in verses 15 and 17. You guys read.
Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death.
17. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. So literally, anyone who attacks or curses their parents, both mother and or father, will be put to death. So in this case, there was no murder that took place. There was just an attack. Somebody struck their parent and somebody cursed their parent. But the penalty is death. Who here has cursed their parents? One person. Only one person? No, but none of you ever curse your parents. Wow, everybody's a saint up in here. I mean, we all did, right? In your bedroom after you got in trouble? Right, not to their face. Right? You all did. We should all be put to death. Right? We all curse our parents. Hopefully nobody here has attacked their parents. So, but why is the penalty so severe? There was no murder that took place. Well, first, physical attacking or cursing of parents is a direct violation of the fifth commandment. What's the fifth commandment? Honor father and your mother, right? Second reason for why the death penalty for the assault and cursing of parents is in order to protect and preserve the family, which in turn will protect and preserve society and the nation. Imagine if we had a nation filled with kids who attacked their parents. A bunch of Menendez brothers. What would happen to society? If you are able to attack your parent, don't you think you'll be able to attack and kill a stranger? It's to protect and preserve society and the nation. The nuclear family is the main building block of society. An attack on the head of the family, namely the father or the mother, is an attack on society as a whole. Again, God's laws are always a provision to protect those who cannot protect themselves. In this case, usually parents are older than their kids, right? Usually. There's no kids that are older than parents. And usually the kids are stronger than their parents. I've never seen a parent who's way stronger than their children. Like, look at my kids right now. If they were to rebel against me, I'd be dead. Especially Caleb. He's a giant. What am I supposed to do with this guy? Right? So it's to protect those who cannot protect themselves. In this case, it's the elderly parents. They're weaker. Right? They will be able to protect themselves. That's why even though the punishment for this crime seems severe, it is for the same purpose, to protect the weak and the vulnerable. Not just the parents, but the vulnerable of society. And this also serves as a reminder for us again, honor your parents, care for them, especially at their advanced age. Amen. All right. Oh, the second miles, yes. Okay. Third capital crime does not involve a murder, but is given the death penalty. Verse 16. Stealing people. I mentioned this when we took up the slave laws, right? And this law is what makes slavery back in the ancient Near East world, ancient Near East different from slavery that we know of today. Again, modern day slavery, even going back to the 1600s, when the transatlantic slave trade boomed, revolved around kidnapping. They were kidnapping people. That was their stock, the people. So they had to get more stock in order to sell. So they had to kidnap. This law forbids it because it's a direct violation of the eighth commandment. What's the eighth commandment? You shall not steal. Kidnapping is the stealing of a person. In this case, stealing of a person in order to enslave. So anyone who does this, might as well have murdered that person that they have kidnapped. Kidnapping for slavery is tantamount to taking a person's life, especially in the ancient world, where the nations around Israel practiced a brutal form of slavery. But if you look at the ancient world, okay, again, the rules are different in Israel than outside. In the ancient world, the laws against kidnapping only applied to upper class people. Like if you were a slave and you just disappeared, you just disappeared. That's it. Right? If you are upper class and you got and you disappeared, you were kidnapped. People will look for you. But if you're a slave, you're not. So when you kidnap a slave to sell them, that's it. They're done. They're just gone. Right? There was no laws to protect slaves from being kidnapped and placed into slavery outside of the nation of Israel. Only in Israel. The people of God, under the rule of God, they're different. Kidnapping is a capital offense, both for the person who committed the crime and even for the person who bought a kidnapped individual. Both of them were punishable by death. So even though no death happened, no murder took place, because kidnapping is tantamount to murder and slavery, these offenses are punishable by death. So now, why then these separate laws for slaves when it comes to violent acts against another human being? Why is there a separate law for slaves? How are we to make sense of these laws? And by the way, these laws also fall under the section of personal injury. Check out 20 to 21, and 26 and 27.
With a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money.
26.
When a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, to destroy him, he shall let the slave go free because of his harm. If he knocks out the foot of his slave, male or female, he shall let the slave go free because of his.
Okay, so right away,
verse 21 presents a problem, right? What does the law say? Verse 21, it says that the law says that slaves who died under the rod of their master will be avenged. This means that the death of a slave in this is equal to murder. Slave is a human being, you kill a slave, you will be avenged. But the second part, verse 21, says that if the slave survives the beating, even for just a day or two, the slave is not to be avenged, for they are the property of their master. So Reichen comments that the assumption here is that the master had the right to issue some form of disciplinary punishment on his slaves. Again, hard to swallow. Right? You put that in our context as Christians. As Christians, we're slaves to righteousness. Right? Right? God is our master. Does he discipline? Yes. In fact, he only disciplines those whom are his children. So isn't that a good thing? But first reading it is like, it doesn't feel right for a master to have the right to issue some form of disciplinary punishment on his slaves. Again, what was the purpose for slavery back then? It had a purpose, right? To teach the slave in order to, once they are set free after 6 years, so they can make it out in the real world. Sometimes you need to discipline so that you can set them up for the real world. Amen? You know, parents who don't discipline are sitting there. Discipline your children. I'm going to get to this later on, but there's nothing wrong with discipline. It's good. God disciplines because we're hard-headed, stubborn people. It's good to be disciplined. And in this sense, the master had the right to issue some form of discipline. However, when it causes a permanent injury, that's not discipline. That's abuse. So there is a provision for that. If your slave loses a tooth or an eye, that's abuse. You can't. If the slave sustains a permanent injury, the slave is to be set free. Again, this is God's provision to stop the abuse of slaves. And this also shows us that the master, even though he's the master, not above the law of God. Still under the law. They are all under it and must pay for the consequences of their actions, either with their own life. If you strike a slave and you kill the slave, you die. If you strike a slave in discipline and you end up injuring them permanently, you set them free. Right? Last, it deals with an animal and its owner. Right? Check it out. 28 to 32.
Ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be eaten. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall be eaten. If a ransom is imposed on him, then he shall give him the angel's life, whatever is imposed on him. If it pours a man's blood on the Lord, it shall be dealt with according to his sin. If the ox pours his blood, male or female, the owner shall give to their master the shekels of silver, and then the ox shall be stoned.
Okay. So these laws fall under the section of criminal negligence. That's why the title of our this sermon is Humane Society. When you think about humane society, what do you think about first? Yeah, animals, dogs, right? But why is humane society all about dogs and animals? Isn't it supposed to be about humans? Isn't it? Right? I'm sure some people are sitting here. What, stone the ox? No. Don't kill the ox. It's not their fault. They're animals. Now, these laws fall under the banner or the section of criminal negligence. The Bible gives us two scenarios in these verses, right? First case is an ox who went crazy and gores a person to death. In such a case, life for life principle is used, right? Guilty animal is put to death. And it's considered dirty. Right? The flesh is not supposed to be eaten. The second case is the animal who has a habit of goring people. In that case, the animal is stoned and its owner is also put to death. The owner can only be redeemed if he can pay for what is demanded of him by the victim's family or the victim's owner. What's the crime? The crime in this situation is that of negligence that caused death. This means that even though we sometimes do not mean for anything bad to happen, if there was a way we could have prevented it from happening but didn't do it, we're both responsible and liable. There's this popular case right now going on in the States, in Michigan, of a school shooting. 15-year-old went into school and shot four of his friends in Michigan. Now, the court, arrested the parent as well. Why? Because the parent knew that his child was suffering from some kind of mental illness, but they were in denial. So she's like, my kid doesn't need any help. Didn't take him to a psychiatrist, didn't get him any help. A few weeks later, took a gun, went to school, shot four people. Parent's name was Jennifer Crubley from Michigan. And the school shooter is 15-year-old Ethan Crubley. The article on cbc.ca said that the conviction of Crumbley's is a first-of-its-kind verdict in a U.S. school shooting case, raising questions about the extent to which a parent can be held responsible for the criminal actions of their child, which could lead to broader implications for the U.S. criminal justice system. How many school shootings happen in the States every year? Lots. Where are the parents of these I get angry if another child hits my child. I want to go after the parent. Like, what are you teaching your kids? Or what are you not teaching your kid? So they're thinking about going back to the other shooting, the Columbine shootings, all these other shootings, the Uvalde shooting. They're thinking about going back. Where were the parents of these children? Both, by the way, in this shooting in Michigan, both the mother and the father were arrested. Why? The mother didn't take the child to get help, mental help. The father didn't store the guns properly. Both of them, negligent. And it caused the death of 4 children. So now, how are we to understand, how are we to apply these truths to our context, especially that of the capital punishment or death penalty? Now, in the Christian community, there's 2 views regarding the issue of capital punishment. Some Christians are for it, saying that capital punishment is necessary. For what? Deterrent, retribution, and the protection of society. The other side says that it's barbaric, discriminatory, and counterproductive. Which one are you? Are you for? By the way, Canada, no capital punishment. They took it off a long time ago. They should put it back in, I think. That's just my thoughts. But which one are you? Are you for capital punishment? Are you against it? What does the Bible say about it? 6:8. Micah 6:8. Check it out.
I don't know if you guys read it.
He's making noise. He has told you, O man, what is good. What is good? And what does God require of you? Do justice. Love kindness. Walk humbly with your God. What does that mean? How do we apply this to capital punishment? So let's do this. I'm going to give you an exercise. Okay. See how you apply Micah 6:8. I want you guys to close your eyes. Now, some of you already eyes closed from the start of the sermon. I want you guys, some of you. You're already imagining the whole thing. Well, everybody, just close your eyes. I'm going to read to you this story. And while your eyes are closed, just imagine what's going on. Close your eyes. Don't look at me. Close your eyes. This story happened in Denham Springs, a rough town east of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. There was a 40-year-old man. His name was Gerald Bordelon. He was already a convicted rapist. On the morning of November 15, 2002, he abducted his stepdaughter. Her name was Courtney, 12-year-old. He took her by knife point to his car, drove her across state lines to Mississippi, forced her to undress, and assaulted her in an unspeakable way. He then led her to a riverbank, pushed her to the ground, strangled her to death, and hid her body under a brush pile, and then drove away. You got that picture in your mind? Now you can open your eyes. What does the Lord require of us in that situation? I hear justice, 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 justice. What about kindness? How would kindness apply that situation? If that was your daughter, what would you do? What would justice look like for you? What would kindness or mercy look like for you? Now, I can only speak for myself. I don't have a daughter. But if I did, and even if something like this happened to one of my boys, Justice for me would be to ask for the death penalty. Nothing less. But mercy and kindness would be to look at my child's killer in the eyes and with forgiveness in my heart share the love of God for him through the gospel. And then from there, let God judge him. At the same time, avenge my child. That's probably the hardest thing. I say it now, easy to say, hard to do. This happened in Rwanda, right? In Rwanda, I forget the names of the tribes. One of the tribes that raided the other tribe, they raped their children in front of them. After the whole thing was done, the mothers of the girls that were raped forgave the rapists, forgave the attackers. Right? It's easy to say, because it's not your child. But if it was, that's what Micah 6:8 would look like. I think. Give him the death penalty, or whatever is the highest penalty there is in wherever country you're supposed to be or where you're at. Give him that. But mercy says, no, save his soul. Kindness says, save his soul. Leave his soul up to God. Share the gospel to this person and let God be the judge. Right? Now, the killer in that story that I read to you was caught a few days later and was sentenced to death on a first-degree murder conviction. But look at what he did. He waived his right to an appeal. Didn't want to appeal it. Why? Because he said, I would commit the same crime again if given the chance. He would do it again. There's some parents here who've seen their child do it over and over and over again. Not doing anything. Not admitting to anything. Always in denial. No, my child can't do that. My child can't do this. Don't want to discipline. Don't be neglectful of parents. I can't imagine sending my kid to school and then you get a phone call. Another student. I can't imagine having to go through that. And it's because of criminal negligence. Bordelon was executed January 7th, 2010. That was the last prisoner to be executed in the state of Louisiana to this day. The administration of justice will always be messy, especially that of capital crime and punishment. So my question for you is this. Is God being too severe when it comes to capital punishment? What does it really mean for a society to be humane? Right? What does it mean to show mercy? Is it to not arrest anybody? Look, that's what's going on right now. In the States, right? They're not arresting people. It's happening in our city. I see a lot of TikTok videos, mostly in Brampton. I'm not saying anything bad about Brampton. But people, they're copycatting what's happening in the States. They're robbing all these stores. No punishment. No repercussion. No nothing. Is it better to be the illegal immigrants in the States beating police officers, and they get away scot-free? One kid even, I think, did a hit and run. Illegal immigrant. They're in there already illegally, and they commit an illegal crime. Nothing. Why? Because they're trying to be humane. Is that what humane is? What about the person that was killed? What about the victims of all these crimes? All the kids that have been shot. Where is the humaneness in that? Right? What does it mean for a society to be humane? Is it to have compassion and benevolence for both killer and their victim? Can we do both? Will this decision have a positive or negative effect on society as a whole? Right? What does it mean to do justice but love mercy and kindness? I want you guys to meditate on those questions. And hopefully, you can reconcile God's goodness and purpose when it comes to His brand of justice. Because for God, the punishment must fit the crime. Right? The punishment must fit the crime. And for God, listen, if God was this, like our liberal government right now, just let everything slide, He wouldn't need Jesus. But the reason why we need Jesus is because God is so holy that any little sin against Him deserves death. But because He's so merciful, He allowed His own Son to take on that penalty for us. What does it look like for you? Sometimes somebody owes us money, we want to kill them. Right? They cut in front of you and when you're driving, you want to kill this person. Then you shake your hand or then you smile at you. What? What does kindness and mercy, justice, doing justice mean for you? Meditate on that. And the next week, we'll move on to the laws about restitution. I hope you can join us again. Amen. Let's pray.
The Lord bless you and keep you.